an opinion that says that kofar is kapora, right? L'chapir al zeh shoharak shu is hordon, right? It's in order to atone for this person, right, whose ox slew, you know, whose ox killed a person, right? In other words, that why does the person who owns the ox have to pay kofar? Because this not only, you know, is monetary compensation, but also it is like a spiritual compensation as well, right?
But how about these enemies of women?
We said, Bahane, these guys, however, la b'nei kapora ninu, right? They're not people who deserve kapora. Why?
Shelohar shoram adam, because in the final analysis,
their ox didn't kill anybody. So, so in that case, they can't get kapora,
right? Well,
it's a little bit involved, I'll be honest with you. But
why,
that's why I go back to my original idea when I said last week.
And why, if you then go to a second court and make a bidui, then you're ordered to.
All right, let's hold that in abeyance for a couple of moments, okay? Yeah, all right, let's continue with the text a little bit, and then we'll come back to your question, okay?
Okay, fine.
All right. All right, so now we come to, you know, having determined that, you know, what is kufra, or kofra, whatever you want to call it. Is it kapora, or is it just monetary? So we see that there is actually a difference of opinion among the sages as to what is its nature, right? So this is what they want to know. It says, Man Tano, who is the Tana who taught that what? That kofra is kapora. In other words, that the two ideas are related to each other, right? So Amar Rav Chisda, who was of course one of the later sages, he said it was an earlier sage. Who was it? It was Rabbi Yishmael ben Osho, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. He was the one, he, right? The Tanya, as we have learned, and now he quotes the Gemara in Baba Kama, where it says, V'nosam pidyon nafshon, that, you know, the Torah says that he is to pay a ransom, literally, or redemption for his soul, which can be interpreted either, as I said, that he has to pay redemption for the soul who's, you know, for the soul that was taken, right? Or he has to pay redemption, which will at least grant him also kapara at the same time. You understand?
No, what's the second? The second is redemption for his own soul and for the second.
Yeah. The person who owned the ox, okay?
Right.
Which killed.
Right.
All right. He is required to give an osan, right, pidyon nafsho. Okay?
Correct.
All right. So the question is, how do you interpret pidyon nafsho?
Right.
Do you simply take it in the sense, you know, that he is required to give monetary compensation for the person who was killed? Right?
Right.
Or do we determine it on the basis that if this person who owned the ox wants to get kapora, he wants to be forgiven for the fact, you know, that his ox gored the person to death, then money alone is not, you know, is not the, is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
It also has to be an atonement for his soul, a spiritual atonement. Understand?
Mm-hmm.
So that this is what the question is. All right. Now, if that's the case, then, you know, we have to look at it in two different ways. Okay. So, anyway, this is what they're asking, they say. All right. All right. So, Amar Rav Papa, so Rav Papa said, excuse me, yes. I see I skipped a line. All right. Skipped a couple of lines, please, me, because they look alike. Or my eyesight isn't what it used to be. All right. He says, Montana Kufra Kapora, right? So, Rabbi Yishmael ben Osho, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, right? He says that the author of that opinion, you know, that Kofar is also Kapora. This was Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who said, the Tanya in the Nosam Pidyon Nafsho, he says, the main Nizak. What is the main Nizak? It means, according to him, if you want to atone, then you have to assess, you know, how much would be the monetary value of the person who was killed.
Right.
The court has to determine that, and this is what the man has to pay in order to get atonement for his soul.
Right.
Okay? Yeah.
The problem I have with this, I hope I'm getting this right. Ox scores a man dies. That's not in
right.
dispute.
Correct.
What's in dispute is whether the ox was a tom or a muat. Right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, if the ox was a tom, right, the owner is not liable. Therefore, he would not pay. Now, just hold.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
You want to call it Dinei Mazik, Dinei Mazikin, or Kapoor, whatever. All right. Conversely, if it is proved to be a Muad, then he is liable. Now, the witness comes and says, the ox is a Muad. All right?
No.
It turns out that it's shown that that witness is a false witness,
no.
which means that the ox was in reality a Tom. I think
well,
we're
maybe
right
it never
this.
Even committed. Maybe never killed a person.
Well, no. I mean, I assume
okay.
not that the man is dead. So,
yeah,
right.
yeah.
so now if the ox is a Tom,
yeah.
the owner has
yeah.
no liability.
Yeah.
Of course you can. Why should the...
There is a certain liability in the case of a Tom, but it's not as severe, you know, as in the case of the Moor. That's
right.
correct.
So then why would the aide logically have why would he logically have any obligation?
What was his... Okay, but what was his purpose in giving false testimony? This is what the question is. Why did he give false testimony? So it was obviously in order to inflict something upon the person against whom he has testified, right?
Oh, all right?
And what would have been the punishment of this person?
Yeah, all right,
okay, then he has to pay kofa. Okay? So that therefore, what should logically be his punishment? That he would be forced to pay
right.
the kofa.
Okay?
okay?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the idea of, you know, of Adam Silverman, that it's, yeah, right. Quid pro quo or tit for tat. Quid pro quo is not exactly a good, because usually we use it in the sense that I do you a favor and you do me a favor, you know. Quid pro quo.
Mm.
Okay? But, you know, this, you know. Well, I do something bad to you, right? Then you're entitled to do something bad to me. Okay. So anyway, all right. The Chachamim say what? That the Nosam Pidyon Nafsho means the main Nizak. In other words, you have to pay for the monetary value of the person who was killed. Now, naturally, why do they say the monetary value? For the simple reason that the person who was killed could be a minor. He could be an older person, right? He could be a person, let's say, an executive with a CEO salary or something like that. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is up to the court to determine. But at any rate, you know, the compensation that the family of the Nizam, right? The compensation of the family of the person who was killed in this particular case has to be determined upon what his value is. Okay? Now, one of the rules of thumb, so to speak, for determining the value is to see if this person were to be sold as a slave in the market, right, how much would he fetch for it? To a certain extent, it reminds us of what we read in the Torah this past Shabbos, where the very last chapter in Sefer Vayikra deals with the concept, you know, of arachin, and there we saw that, first of all, you know, it's divided according to age and according to gender, right? But then after that, if a person, let's say, says, you know, that, let's say, the me or lie, I want to donate, you know, to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Hekdash, whatever my value is, then how do they know how to determine what his value is? They don't go for his bank books, because they didn't have banks in those days. So presumably they didn't have bank books, okay? So what do? So they have to estimate how much would he draw on the market if he were to be sold as a slave. Not that he's going to be sold as a slave, but, you know, how much would he be worth under those circumstances? Not only that, but in the case of Arochen, you have to have 10 assessors to judge him. It's what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, and one of these assessors at least must be a Kohen. So, you know, the assumption being, you know, that among 10 people, there are certainly people who have practical experience and know, you know, how to determine the value of a human being. Okay? So, the same thing with the Domain Nizak. If it's only a child who was killed, obviously, then the compensation that the family is going to get would not be the same as if it were an adult. I mean, that stands to reason. Unfortunately, we know that a child's life is precious just as an adult's. But, you know, when it comes to a matter of compensation, then already, there are other factors that enter in it. I mean, just as, for example, let's say that you're injured, right, in a court or something like that, or a person is killed by an automobile. Mm-hmm. And then what? I mean, how does the court determine, how much compensation? Of course, I know the insurance companies have tried to get away with it, but still, mm-hmm. you bring them to trial or something, and, then what is the court going to base its assessment on? How much this person was able to earn in his lifetime, how many more productive years mm-hmm. would he presumably have had, and mm-hmm. things like that, right?
Okay.
This is the way they do it. All right, now, what about Rabbi Shmuel? Rabbi Shmuel, on the other hand, says, Ar Savar, in other words, in this case, happens to be Rabbi Shmuel's opinion, he says, be the mazik shaymin, that we have to determine what is the value of the person who actually did the harm, the mazik. By the way, this is a general principle which extends, not just to the question of the shor, the ox that killed the person, but in general. How do you determine, in a case where A injures B, right? So how do you determine on what basis, does A have to compensate B? What does he have to compensate him for? So, of course, the Gemara and, Baba Kama has different things that you have to take into consideration. As, for example, how long did this person have to stay home and he was unable to work? Or has he been so permanently injured that he cannot go back to work again? How do you determine then, what he might have earned and so on, and try to reach a reasonable amount? Okay? Doctor's bills. These things. Also, if you cause the person pain, then in certain circumstances, a person is entitled to compensation for the pain and suffering that he's having. Okay? So these are all factors that determine. So the only difference over here is according to his opinion. According to the Rabbanan, the determination or the assessment, if you wish, is made on the basis of the person who was injured, the nizak, right? Whereas, according to Rabbi Yishmael, it is based on the mazik. Okay? And as they say, my tamay the rabbanon. What is the reason of the rabbis? Nemar hashosa lemato, v'nemar hashosa lemale. It's written, that im kofer yushas olav, or in the case of a guy was involved in an accident and he hit a pregnant woman and she miscarried. So in that particular case, the Torah says, that he has to pay the husband of the woman whatever compensation the court decrees, and the term that he was, yushas olav. So in one case it's in kofa yushas olav and kechol asher yushas olav. Okay, so since the two are related ideas, so in that particular case,
did we miss Rav Kafa?
Right. Whoa. You are 100% right. Sorry. Okay. All right. So Omer Rapapa said, Lo duchli yama kufra kapora. No, he says that in truth, everybody agrees that kofar does serve also as a kapora, but the question is, where do we place the emphasis, right? So here, in this particular case, what is the difference of the two points of view that they are in disagreement with each other? So it says, Mar Sovab Nizok Shaiminen, right? That Mar, meaning one authority in this case, who in this case happened to be the Chachomim, right? They are the authority, they are the opinion that you have to evaluate, the person who has been injured. It's on his, it's based on his injuries. Well, Mar Sovab the Mazik Shaiminen. The other one says it's based upon what harm has the mazik himself, or how much is he worth, to know how to assess, what he should do in order to atone, for the harm that he done.
So the, let me understand, yes, the two methods, right, of damages, because this is voluntary. The two methods, one is the injured party or the victim's,
right,
damages, which,
right,
we've already outlined.
Right, that's the diesel, yeah.
That's actually what we use, yeah, today, I mean, in general.
Right,
in general.
Right. The other, as I said, that Chachamim, I mean, their point of view prevails in this particular case.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah. Okay.
The other one is actually, they go back and they try to, using what was in Bar Midbar, they try to use what the Eric of the injuring party would be.
Yeah, I mean, don't confuse the two. I only gave it as an example. I mean, because Arachin has a technical, technical value.
Well,
okay.
Then let me ask, what is the May Mazik?
Yeah, the May Mazik means that you have to pay on the basis of how much is the person who did the harm. How much is he worth?
That's fine.
Okay?
Okay,
so that presumably, we would say that if this is the case, then if this is a person of means, then the court could fine him more,
right?
Than in the right than in the case of somebody who doesn't have the same means.
Just this one is a kapara.
Yeah,
so
right.
For him to appreciate.
For him,
the
right, in order to achieve the kapara, right, for you know the fact that he hurt the other person, exactly. Okay. Yeah. So my tamal rabbanu nema hashos lemaltov and nema hashos lemalo. Right, in two different cases, the expression yushas olav is found. Right. I'm going to be more technical, but anyway, the idea is the verb is the same, right? Namely, that a monetary payment has to be imposed upon him, which is what the word yushas, the word shos in Hebrew means, you know, to put or to give or something like that. So yushas means that he is forced to give, okay? Or is placed upon him, is imposed upon him, and. Yeah, so mala halam bidin izok, just as in the case, you know, where the woman was injured, you understand? That is, the woman, that she miscarried, right? And she lost a child,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And the Torah says that he has to pay whatever, you know, the husband determines, you know, would be just compensation. So it was based upon the nizok, upon the person who was harmed, right? So I've come to the nizak. So likewise over here in the business, you know, with the ox killing a person. So again, the amount of money would be based upon the value of the nizak. Okay. The Rabbi Yishmael interprets for nosam pikanafsho kisiv. Right. He says, look, it's written in nosam pikanafsho, which would mean what? That he has to give. In other words, the mazik has to give whatever. You know, the court assesses him in order to achieve pidyon, literally, in this particular case, redemption for his soul, or kapara, right? All right. Now, Nosam pidyon avshuk sim, right. Now, Rabbonim, so how about the rabbis, since after all they also have the same pasuk? So he says, in, yeah. You know, that's one of the problems with Aramaic. That the word in the Hebrew word ain look alike. The spelling is exactly alike, but actually it's not the negative over here. It means in, yes. It says pidyonafsho ksir. Yeah, right, it's true that the word pidyonafsho is written over there. In other words, the guy has to give the amount of money which will bring him atonement, right? Mihu, nevertheless, kishai minan, nevertheless, when it comes to, to assessing the value, so. According to the Chachamim, it's been nizak shemim. It had to do with the nizak, with the person who has been injured. Okay. Now the next one that we said over there is the einim korim the eved ivri, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That they cannot be sold as an eved ivri.
Yeah,
as a Hebrew slave, right? So they couldn't be sold as a Canaanite slave either. But you realize that in the Torah they do make a distinction between eved ivri and between eved kanani. Okay. Well, I mean, they don't use the word Eved Kanani, but, the implication is clear, right, that somebody who's a non-Jew, you know, who is sold into slavery, the different laws that apply in that case. Okay. So, all right. Why not Engen Kom Eved Ivri? So Rav Hamnuna Lemeimor, so Rav Hamnuna was the opinion that what it means in this case is Hani Milei, this would apply Heichod Yisrael Didei, where he, that is, where the person whom they accuse of having committed geneva, okay, remember, what is the charge over here? They say that this guy was a ganav, right? And then what did we say? That if the ganav doesn't have the wherewithal, then in that particular case, right, he has to be sold by the Beis Din into slavery in order to pay off the debt that he owes. Okay? Now, these guys come along and they say that he stole. Correct? Why are they not liable to be sold as Hebrew slaves? This is what the question is. So he says, well, Rav Nuna said that the first, that how about maybe the case is maybe this man who they accused of stealing has enough money on his own in order to pay the person who he was accused of stealing from, right? So that he doesn't have to become, he would not have to be sold into slavery, right? So if that's the case, if he would not have been sold into slavery in the first place because he has the money in order not to be, right? Mm-hmm. So he says, the migu, the ihu lo nizamin, inasmuch as he would not be sold into slavery. So inu nami lo nizamin, in that case they too can't be sold into slavery, right? In other words, what could their taina be? The taina could be before the court, hey, you can't sell us into slavery, you know why? That guy has money. He wouldn't have been sold as a slave anyway, so you can't punish us.
He was ransomed.
Right, out. Right. But where he doesn't have the money, then in that case, this is Rav Habnuna's opinion, right? He says that even though they have money, these Adam Zomimim, but because the person against whom they testified didn't have the money and would have been sold into slavery, then in this case, what is the proper and just punishment for them? That they should be sold into slavery.
Oh, really?
This is the idea, okay? So, Omale Rava, so Rava disagrees, okay? At any rate, he says, Valei Mulei, so why couldn't they say to him, hey, look, Ian Tava Lacha, right? The Habim is Damit, look. If you had the money, would you have been sold into slavery? So obviously the answer is no. So therefore we too do not deserve, you know, to be sold into slavery. That's not the right punishment for us. So Rav Hamnuna the Meimor. So therefore they give a different interpretation now for what Rav Hamnuna said. He says, no, this is really what we meant to say, he says. Ha neimiloi heichad islei olididei olididhu. This applies where we said that they cannot be sold into slavery when either he has the wherewithal so that he would never be sold, or they have the wherewithal so that they could get themselves out of it, you know, by paying the money. Okay? Abol Heicha, the less lay, lo ledid, lo ledid, whom is dummy? But where they neither he has nor they have the wherewithal, then in that case they should be sold into slavery. So Rava disagrees with Rav Hamnuna. So Omalei Rava, so Rava says to him, he says, oh, the Torah says, when Nimka Bignevo, so he is to be sold for his theft, right? Omar Rachman, this is what the Torah said. So Bignevo, so he could be sold, you know, if he doesn't have the wherewithal to pay back the money that he stole, right, for his theft. But Velo Bizmomo, but not, you know, for simply wanting to, you know, to declare this person, you know, a ganav. Okay? So that's how they get out of it. So obviously, that's the reason why they're not going to be sold into slavery. Okay. Now we come to the last case, which was about Rabbi Akiva, if you remember. And what did he say? He said, you know, that they cannot be forced, you know, if they go to a second court of law, to pay. Ein Mishaman al pi atzmo, right? Alright. So the question is, my Talmud Rabbi Akiva. What is the reasoning behind Rabbi Akiva's statement over here? After all, Rabbi Akiva was one of the great Chachomim, so he must have had some good logical reasoning, you know, why he made the statement. So he says, the Rabbi Akiva Kosovar, he thought that Kenosahu, right? He says that you know, what the court is imposing is really a fine. It's a fine. we think in terms that, you know, it's monetary compensation, but it's not that cut and dry. It's really that the court is imposing a fine upon them because, you know, either it could be more or it could be less than the actual amount, you know, that would have been assessed, okay? And as far as the knas is concerned, then uknas ein mishalem pi atzmo. A person cannot, by his own admission, make himself liable to the payment of a knas, of a fine. Why? So let's look at the Rashi down at the bottom, okay? Second line from the bottom over there. Knas ein mishalem pi atzmo. You see that?
Yep.
This is it, because it's written gabe kefil in reference to where the ganav has to pay a double amount. Remember we spoke about that if a person steals, right? So he's a ganav. Then in that particular case, in Yimotzei HaGanav, right? If the ganav is found, then Yishalim Shlaim, he has to pay twice the amount. Okay? Now, obviously, this is more than just compensation. This is already a fine imposed upon him by the Beis Din, right?
100%.
So, right. So that, therefore, what Rashi is saying over here says, like, the Siv Gabi Kefil, Asher Yashiyun Elohim. In other words, whoever the judges condemn to pay this penalty, so Prat, this therefore excludes what? L'mashiyah Satzmo, a person who makes himself into a Rasha. That is, he claims, you know, that he did something bad. For that, you cannot impose a fine. You can impose other things, but not a knas itself, okay? So that's the reason why, in this particular case, they don't pay. Now.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
But this is saying, I mean, Rabbi Akiva said it, Rashi,
right.
Shirtson.
Yeah.
In other words, that, in effect, admissions or confessions have no basis. Right? I mean, they're not.
No, this is not true. It's not a universal rule. Okay. You raised a very important question, but I have to tell you right now that the question of confession, you know, that you admit, okay, let's use the word admit. The word Hebrew, you know, in Moded, in the Hebrew, is the same word, okay. But let's say admission, okay? In monetary matters, admission is important. As a matter of fact, there's a Gemara which says that, you know, Hodas Baldin is the equivalent of Kameo Eidim Domo. Okay. It's as if you had 100 witnesses. In other words, it certainly has very important value. Okay? And then, of course, we have another problem. It's another technical problem that arises, and that is what they call Modi Ben Mixas Satina. Okay, Modi Ben Mixas Satina means that you confess to half of what the complaint is against you. In other words, you're charged with two things, and you admit to one charge. So, and of course, you know, that in itself, you know, that depends, you know, how much you are assessed, and what are you free from assessing. Because what you've done is to say that I admit half the amount, so that therefore, what will the court say? Pay that thing, okay? But after the thing that they say, you know, he says that he didn't do it, right? And he's not owing that. So in that case, he has to take an oath before the court. And I don't have to tell you that that he's innocent of the second charge against him, okay? So in that particular case, if he takes this oath, then he would be free from having to pay for that part of the charge placed against him. But, you know, to us, the way people unfortunately are swearing falsely right and left, you know, perjuring themselves and so on, we have to bear in mind that, you know, from a point of view of a God-fearing Jew, this is one of the worst things that you could do. Because you're swearing by the name of God, or you're swearing, let's say, by holding on to a Sefer Torah. You understand?
Yes.
And you're deliberately telling a lie over there. And we feel that the average person, you know, who's a committed Jew, is not going to have the huzzahs, we would say. In other words, he's not such an azponim, you know, so impudent that he's going to take an oath falsely.
Right.
Because, you know, he's aware of the fact that, you know, the Rabbeinu Shlom is not going to look very kindly upon him. And he'll eventually, you know, be judged on this particular basis. So that, therefore, you see, this is the reason why the oath, you know, absolves him from that part which he claims he's innocent of, but not of that part which he had confessed, you know, that he does owe, whatever it may be. Okay?
So you're saying that it's
yeah.
a civil matter, if it's a matter
right.
of money, and
yeah.
he makes an admission, then he can be subject to a monetary...
Right. Okay, that brings us into another area altogether.
But if it's a criminal like this...
Okay, good.
Because this is an accusation
right.
being a false witness, and there's an
yes.
admission...
Right.
He's not subject to a fine.
Right. And here, you know, we have a new principle that's at work, and this is the principle that we find particularly in the Gemara Sanhedrin, which is, after all, it's the, you know, the central tractate, you know, which deals with crime and punishment, okay?
Right.
All right. So there we have a statement to the effect that Ein Odom Mesimis Atzmo Rasha.
Right.
A person cannot be forced to testify against himself
right.
because no one has the right to declare to make himself into a Russian.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, I mean, the Fifth Amendment, of course, you know, is based upon that idea. But this is a fact. A person cannot testify against himself. And even if he should want to testify against himself, the court is adjured not to to accept his confession in this particular case. Yeah, I mean, morally he could confess, but still, he can only be condemned if actually there were witnesses who were there in order to testify that they saw him do it, that they warned him not to do it, and that they stressed the fact that he would be given the death penalty if he continued, you know, and he persisted in doing it, and so on and so forth, you see. So I don't have to tell you, you know, how difficult it is to try to even enforce a death penalty when you have all these rules and regulations when it comes to testimony and to the relations between judges and witnesses and so on.
And the wife
yeah.
and so on.
Right. Yeah, it's another thing. Obviously, a wife cannot be forced to testify against her husband or a husband against the wife. It goes without saying.
It's interesting that
yeah.
the state is still... struggle with the problem of who has the money to pay the monetary penalty,
yeah.
even in the bail situation.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't have bail. He may be in jail for a year when he probably had a 1 month penalty fine. You know, that would
well,
yeah,
I suppose
the bail
that,
situation
right.
is out of whack in modern society.
Yeah. I thought that you had these people who give bail
they
want a buck or something.
But
yeah.
bail is,
the guy can't afford the bail bond.
Right.
Well, in this state, it almost.
Right, you cannot do it. And we quoted the Rashi over there at the bottom. Okay, so we'll start from Omar Rabbah, which is the second line from the bottom next week. Im Yotza Hashem. Okay.
Okay.
And we'll continue. And don't worry, we're moving.
Slowly, but we're moving.
Slowly,
okay.
but surely
yeah,
we're moving.
That,
okay. All right. So, at any rate, just to review the last statement that we read last week, which was three lines from the bottom, it said, right, my Tama de Rabbi Akiva, Kosova Kenosa Hu, Kenosa Mishama Di Atzmo, right? Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that, you know, that this business about the money, you know, that they would have to pay is, in the final analysis, it's not payment, let's say, for services or anything like that, but it is a fine that's imposed upon him. And as far as the fine is concerned, then in that particular case, a person cannot impose upon himself a fine. That he can't do, all right? And this is what Rabbi Akiva said. He says, "Oknos eino mishalma piyatzbo." And again, let's take a look at the Rashi, two lines from the bottom over there. Knos eino mishalma piyatzbo, he says, "Dirsiv," because the pasuk says, "Gabe kefil," in connection with, you know, where a person has to pay twofold for what he has stolen. In other words, if he stole, let's say, $5, he would have to pay $10 back, or something like that, right? Now, this obviously is not paying back what we would call the principal, which in general, you know, would be, you know, if I owe you money, I pay you back the money. Interest, of course, cannot, you know, that doesn't enter in it at all, because that's prohibited by Jewish law. So, that's it. But, in this particular case, where, you know, he has to pay back $10, why? Because the Torah has a special provision that says that in Yemotzi Aganav Yemotzi Yishalim Shtayim, that if the Ganav is found, then he has to pay back a double amount. So that is kefil. I mean, that is kefil. I mean, the double amount. Or let's say, you know, if he stole, let's say, a sheep or an ox. Okay, there the Torah has a different statement about the sheep or the ox. About the sheep, it says that he has to pay back. You know, and you know, he slaughtered it. Okay, he slaughtered it. All right. So it's four sheep he has to pay, right, to replace the sheep that he stole,
right,
or five oxen,
right,
for the ox that you know, he stole and he slaughtered. Okay, of course we're talking about where he's either he sold it to somebody and can't be
reclaimed,
or he slaughtered it himself. Okay, so that he certainly can't pay back the, you know, the animal that he had stolen. So in that case, he is fined either by a fourfold or by a fivefold penalty. But again, this is a penalty. This is a knas. And who is entitled to levy a knas? There are a couple of other cases of knas also in the Torah course. I mean, one of them is a case, you know, of a person, of a man seduces a virgin.
Right.
Okay? Seduces. Didn't rape her. I'm not saying about that. Okay? But if he seduces her, then, you know, there's a penalty of chamishim kesef. He has to pay to the father of this girl, has to pay 50 silver coins, whatever the value was in those days. Okay.
I thought the penalty was he had to marry her.
With the marriages already, it's a different problem. Okay, yeah. But at any rate, you know, he is fine. Okay. Yeah. If, on the other hand, for example, you know, he made a claim, you know, against a woman, you know, that he had married, you know, he said that she was not a virgin when he married her, and the parents proved that she was a virgin. They have testimony to that effect, okay? Then in that particular case, you know, then not only has to pay, you know, plenty of guilt, but also he's not allowed to divorce her either. That he can't do, right? Because otherwise, obviously, he wanted to get rid of her. So we say, okay, buddy,
you're stuck with her.
So that's knas. It's something which, you know, goes beyond principle. It's something. And now, who can levy knas? So as the Rashi says over here, it says, you know, asher yashiyun Elohim, those who the judges themselves condemn, right? So in other words, we see already what? That it takes a bezdin, it takes a court of judges in order to assess a fine. How much of the, you know, the person would have to pay. And prat, and this excludes the marshi esatzmo, the person who says on his own, you know, that I owe a knas, I owe a penalty. That doesn't work. Okay. All right. So,
the fact that he admits it, it doesn't make it, it doesn't automatically pay it. They have to go to court based in.
Right. And as I spoke last week, you know, at great length, you know, about the person who is moded. I mean, he confesses that he owes money. Then what is it? So we saw, I mean, that the normal procedure is that if a person says that he's moded, then in that particular case, it's kemeya edim domi. That has the effect of having 100 witnesses to say, hey, you know, yeah, he really took the money. And so on, like then he has to pay it back. And so on, okay? But there are times that a person cannot condemn himself. That we saw, you know. And, you know, this is particularly true in criminal cases that he cannot condemn himself. That he cannot be Mashiach Satzma. So we make a distinction between Mode, or Hodor, in other words, which means that you confess to having done something, as compared to making yourself into a Rasha, that you condemn yourself by your own mouth in a criminal case.
Perhaps you might put it better, the difference between admission, which is mamon, and confession, which would be, you say karshana.
Okay, all right.
Perhaps if you'd like to do that.
Fine. Look, you're the legal expert.
Technical difference between admission and confession.
Yeah.
You can admit it, but don't.
Yeah, hadol would be like admission. You're right.
Admission,
I mean,
this
is really
fact.
What it
you
comes
can admit
to.
Like.
You admit
fact.
The fact, right?
So
yeah.
It can cover a variety of circumstances or instances.
Right.
Whereas
whatever. Confession, you usually
you
confess
admit
that
it,
you
but
did
don't
wrong.
Put it in writing.
Right. Yeah.
Confession means you're
right. Right. You confess that you did wrong. You're right.
Confession
okay. Very good.
Usually,
so yashikaya. All right. Now, in reference to the statement of Rabbi Akiva, we have two little statements that are now appended.
And the first one is Rabba. Omar Rabba. Rabba said, hey, he says, you know, we can prove the fact that in the case of Edom and Zomimim, what is imposed upon them is really in the nature of a fine and not, you know, simply a repayment in the fact that Sha'arei Le'osu Maaseh, they didn't do anything, and yet he says, Umishalman, they have to pay. Or another version is Vnei Erogim, that they could be put to death, even though they didn't do anything. What do you mean by they could be put to death? Let's say if they testified against the person that, you know, he deserved capital punishment for a crime that they had witnessed, and then they proved to be false witnesses, then in that case, technically, they could be punished with the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Okay. As far as Mishalman, this already is a different question, because the question is, what is Mishalman? I don't want to go into, you know, all the drawing a finger around, okay? General,
does that
yes.
Anything to do with the definition of Katzma?
Of what?
Katzma.
I don't understand.
Well, the definition of Katzma is understood to be fine.
The definition of what word? Zoma is what we're talking about. Adam Zomimim. Hazoma is the action, and the Adam Zomimim is the witnesses who have, you know, they are being challenged, you know, as to the veracity of the testimony that they give. Okay?
Yeah,
that's Hazoma. Okay.
Skulk guys really, you know,
yeah.
Way ahead of the rest. Yeah, you know, I have to tell you that.
I was thinking there was a question with the definition about Hazoma.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Mishalman part, this, the reason why I'm a little bit skeptical as to whether it belongs over here or whether Neherogim is correct, there could be two possibilities. Possibility number one would be that if we say that both words belong in the text, Neherogim and Mishalman, there may be a case, theoretically, where an Eid Zome can be put to death, and at the same time, let's say his estate has to pay back the money that they would have caused to be forfeited as a result also. But, you know, that's such a rare case.
Why do they have to be concurrent?
Huh?
Why do they have to be concurrent?
Well, as I say, this is really a rare case, because normally our principle is different. The principle is it's kim lay b'derabam yinit, which means that...
It doesn't necessarily imply that it's
right,
concurrent. In
right.
Circumstances, certain instances it's nerogim, certain instances it's mishalman.
Yeah.
And since they've not done the
right.
crime...
Okay.
It makes it
the reason why I'm... trying to define it over here is because of the next statement, where definitely it is Mishalman
yeah.
that they have in mind. Okay?
Yeah.
So that's why. But, you know, Rashi takes the Herogim as being the correct reading. Why? Take a look at the bottom over there. Alright? He says that over there, Teda. You see it at the bottom over there?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. He says, Teda, you should know. He says, the Knosser. How do we know that the case of Adam Zomimim, you know, that this is Knoss? He says, Sha'arei, Hani Edim Medefesh. Right? That they who testify against the person that he deserves capital punishment, right? So, Lehorgu Adam, they themselves did not commit murder, right? Velo Neherag Adam Al Pihem, and this person whom they had accused is not put to death. Why? Because they were proved to be Adam Zomimim.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there was no person who was put to death at this particular point.
No
right? And nevertheless, Benehrogim, they can be executed, technically, right?
Uh-huh.
Right? They can be technically executed, okay?
Right?
Yeah, technically they could be. Because the punishment is, you know, that what they... purpose to do to the other, that's, you know, kasher zomam, right? So in that case, you know, they should get the penalty that they wanted to give the other. Umishalmit momam, and they also have to pay money. So when could it be? So as I say, sometimes they could have, by their testimony, convicted a person that he would have had to both give money and also that he was guilty of a capital punishment, okay? So, in this particular case, if we accept the reading exactly the way it is, then we have to say, you know, that they can be punished both by being put to death, because this is what they had planned to do, you know, to the person against whom they testified falsely, and at the same time, the money that he would have lost also as a result of their testimony, so that they're still forced to pay, either he or the estate would have to pay, whatever it may be. So, this is what Rabba is saying over here. Okay,
like
but as I said, we do have a different principle, and that principle is that Kim labor the Rabba Bini, if a person deserves two punishments, then we say in that case, what is the punishment that he gets? He normally gets the more severe one.
What is the pitkam again?
Kim lay. But the rabo mine.
The rabo mine, okay.
Right. Okay?
Don't quote that to the judge.
I don't think it ever was taken
it's very
to
unusual.
One instance.
Pardon me?
I don't think the phrase was ever taken to refer to one instance.
No, there are times.
Narugan and Mushaman can refer to two. So I would think the simple translation is it refers to separate instances.
Now, I agree that it could also be interpreted that way. I agree, it could be. It could be that the vav in this particular case means that not both, but simply one or
the other.
Okay? But then the question is, so Omer Rab Nachman, he comes along and he says, Teda, he says, you should know, Sharei Momon Biyad Olim Amishomim, right? Look, the money that they wanted to cause the person against whom they testify, right? He doesn't lose it because they were proven to be false, so that guy still has his money, right? That's the Olim, in other words, the person who possesses the money, he still has it in his possession, right? And Mishalman, these guys, they have to pay, right? Mm-hmm. So this is why the Gemara now asks the next question, which is on the top of the next page. It says, my Nihu, tell me, it says, this money, how come, you know, that, you know, they would have to pay the Leosu Masa, because they didn't perform any deed? So he says, I know the robber. So in that case, you know, Taka, you're right, he says. So let's amend the text to say not, you know, Omer Rab Nachman, but let's add one little word. What is it? V'chein Omer Rab Nachman. And likewise, Rab Nachman said the same thing. In other words, that what? In the case of where he would have had to forfeit money, that, you know, so the Edom Zomim have to forfeit money instead. Yeah. Okay.
Wait. What are the Chachamim saying now that in the case where...
In other words, this is why Rabba really, I think, probably is laying the stress upon the Neherogim that they are possibly, you know, liable, let's say, to a death penalty. Okay? Umishalmim, and they would have to raise money, or they would have to pay money, right?
Right.
And Rab Nachman comes along and says, yeah, Taka, they have to pay money because even if it's just money, not a capital, right? So they didn't do anything technically because the person still has the money
still
in his possession,
right?
But we're forcing them, you know, to pay the money that he would have lost. Okay.
Nobody addresses
which seems to go, that's...
Right.
The primary difficulty, of course, being that they were on the verge of being penalized when they bolted and ran to the second base. By virtue of running off to another court, they can absolve themselves of the penalty that was about to be inflicted.
Yeah.
Unique
yeah.
Situation,
right. There was. But we'll get back to that a little bit in the text itself, okay? Because we're not finished with the subjects yet, okay? We still have a little bit to work on. Okay, Ron.
Take care.
Yeah. Okay. So, now the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, he says, Eid Zomeim Mishalim Lepi Chelka. He says that Eid Zomeim, you know, a witness, you know, who testifies falsely, as in this case, he has to pay his share of the penalty that has been assessed. In other words, according to this particular statement, let's say that they said that, you know what, Chaim borrowed $500 from Yossel, right? And he didn't repay him the money. Whereas in reality, Chaim had already repaid Yossel, okay? So in that particular case, what is the penalty that they would have to pay Chaim? They'd have to pay him $500, right? Mm-hmm. But since you must have at least two witnesses, so that therefore is each witness assessed the $500, or can they split it? So according to this statement of you know, Rav Yehuda, in the name of Rav, he says actually they split it. Okay, Eid Zomim Mishalim Fi Chelko. He has to pay according to his share in it. So my mishalim lefi chelko. So what do we mean that he pays according to his share? So he says, ilaymor. If we say the high mishalim palgo, the high mishalim palgo, that one pays half and the other one pays half, right? So he says, tanina, we learned a different statement, and that statement says mishalshin mimamon, v'yem mishalshin mimakos, which means literally you can split it in three when it comes to money. And you don't split in three when it comes to Malkus. All right. Okay, English translation. All right. Let's say that they borrowed, let's say, $600. Okay? All right?
Yeah, if you want to.
All right.
They accuse someone of
having. Right, they accuse someone of having. Okay, then in that particular case, how much would be assessed if there were three witnesses? Don't forget, the law says, I'll pish da'i made him, or shlosha ate him. And the Gemara wants to know, and it's Gemara in Sanhedrin, okay. Why does it say Al Pish Dai Maidim and Shlosha Edim, you know, according to two witnesses or three witnesses? So the answer is that you can have even 100 witnesses. It makes no difference. But the point is, you know, that the testimony has to agree.
Definitely.
Right. And, you know, if any one witness would come along and give testimony which is at complete variance with what the other witnesses have to say, then in that the case, what do we say? We say it is some potato. The whole witness, the whole testimony is thrown out of court.
Wait.
Yeah.
This is very interesting what you're going to say in order to the, I guess you'd call like Ra'ayat Tirah, something like that. In other words, you're saying that if 99 witnesses come and testify to this financial transaction,
right?
And one witness testifies like a rebuttal in a sense, like an aid hasama.
No, he's not aid hasama.
He's not an aid hasama.
He's an aid hasama. He's not saying that Ted is saying things false. But what he's saying is, you know, that when they question him,
I don't mean
the other witnesses, right? So on certain vital things, there is a marked difference in the testimony given. Okay,
and that in fact.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
All right. The Gemara in the Sanhedrin, for example, we'll give the following example.
Right.
Let's say somebody says that the event that I'm testifying to took place on the 2nd of March. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, let's say the other witnesses will say, yeah, we saw it happen on the 2nd of March. Right. Along comes the last witness, if you wish, right?
Right.
And he says, no, it wasn't the 2nd of March, it was the 5th of March.
Mm-hmm.
All right, 9th of March. 5th of March.
Next
so, obviously, in that case, then, we have to say that the testimony is no good.
Wow. See,
okay?
That's very interesting to me.
But okay. What if he said, you know, one person said that it happened on the 2nd of March, and the other one said it happened on the 3rd of March, then already we could say, well, you know, he didn't look at the calendar that well, so a person can make a mistake by a day. Okay?
What is the difference between the two situations?
A person can make a mistake by a day. He's not going to make a mistake, however, when it comes to 3 days or 10 days or something like that.
Okay.
You see, that's a difference.
Fine.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. So when it's a glaring error, you know, the glaring disagreement in the testimony, then in that particular case, we have to say that the testimony is no good. Because in the final analysis, the testimony has to be based on the agreement of the witnesses on the principal points of testimony.
So,
okay?
Actually, the burden of proof,
yeah,
the natara ayah, has to be almost comprehensive.
Yeah.
It has to be, it can't be a preponderance, it can't be beyond 50%, it has to be practically an invulnerable presentation of proof, because what you're saying, if 99 people testify one way and one person, not a rebuttal, but it's just someone testifies to one material fact a different way, that will destroy the whole evidence against the accused.
Interesting.
Am I correct in assuming,
however, that it's unlikely that 99 witnesses would be called, in that the first two witnesses, if they were in complete agreement,
yeah,
they'd say, okay, they're in a complete
agreement.
He's going to be executed.
But you see, the problem comes when three come forward,
when four come forward.
Okay,
so four. Yeah. But the point is that it's not going to be 99. So if you get, you can accept that there's four people who made a mistake or four people in conspiracy. But if one person says, now hold on a second, they've got this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to get 99 people in the conspiracy. You might get two, three, four. So you wouldn't get more than four witnesses anyway.
Yeah, remember another thing. That certainly in capital cases, you know, where the death penalty could be involved, each witness was questioned separately, apart from the other witnesses, so that the other witnesses could not hear what the individual witness was saying. And of course, you know, the court is recording it. They had two recorders in the Besdin. And, you know, so that if somebody made a mistake, then, you know, you could go back to the record and check. Okay?
I don't want to belabor this. I just thought I wanted to respond to what David said. Let us take your example of four witnesses that testify to a murder taking place on a certain day in a certain location. Right. And one fifth witness comes along and gives a materially different version of where the act took place and what day, by a week, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would think in our contemporaneous system of law, the witness's testimony would be weighed, whether the one person impeached the testimony of the four or the four impeached the testimony of the one. The weight and sufficiency of the evidence would be tossed back and forth. But here, unless I'm misunderstanding, is that in a sense, automatically, the rights of the accused are so strong that automatically, if there's any material version, alteration of the version brought about by one of that group of witnesses, that the case, in a sense, is thrown out.
Yes.
Is that correct? See, this is
that's correct. The case will be thrown out, as I say. The testimony is not...
If we want to catch you up and we say, all right, let's get him locked up for a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just tired of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it will, if you don't shut up.
But then already, he has a friend... You're assuming that witnesses want to perjure. And, of course, this is the problem with David Zimmerman. But here we're not talking about perjury.
Not only that.
Talking about witnesses who testify in all...
Inconsistently.
Innocence, right? But the testimony doesn't jive, you see.
But if, as Phil explained before, many times the Sanhedrin goes into a very, very careful cross-examination of the witness.
Right.
So
right.
that it would be almost impossible for, let's say, 99 guys to say the same identical story, and one guy not to come by and say something else.
Yeah.
You have to suspect something.
Yeah,
that was a collusion,
right? But to get back, to the main point. The main point is that testimony has to be considered as, you know, every witness is responsible for the testimony and has to be considered as one testimony. Ages, okay? So that being the case, if in this particular case, let's say there were three witnesses who came and they said that Chaim owed Shimon the money that he borrowed from him and never repaid, and let's say it was $600 because it's easy, then in that case, Mishalshim means that each witness is going to have to pay how much?
$200
each, right? Because if you have three witnesses, then we'll come to that. Okay? Now, how about Malchus, however? They deserve punishment because they gave false testimony, and they should get a flogging as a result. Huh?
That's interesting.
You don't share it. Don't say, all right, 39, we'll give each one 13. Don't do that.
To pay the money back, pay the money and get Malchus also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right? As the Gemara would say, Lokin, they get Malchus from Mishalman, and they have to pay.
Okay.
And that's perfectly legitimate. Okay, that Loke and the Mishalman, they can get Malchus in the same time. They have to repay the money that they would have caused that guy to lose. Okay. So
can
in the one case, the money, as we see, that could be shared. But the Malchus, each one of them has to be shared.
Can I ask a Klotz-Kasher question? I apologize. Let's say it's a case where only two witnesses are necessary to convict, and there are three witnesses that testify.
Yeah.
In that case, why should the third witness actually have to pay anything? Because you can understand that the division of the monetary penalty is tied to the proof that the two witnesses gave which would determine the conviction.
Yeah,
because
where,
the third person was extraneous.
No, I understand what you're saying is he didn't have to testify. But the fact is, he did come forth and testify. So in that case, he bears his share of the responsibility.
Except that his testimony wasn't necessary for the conviction.
Well, hold on.
But it makes no difference. If he came forth and he testified, in that case he deserves some punishment for that too.
If there were three shepherds together and they stole something from one person, the three of them would testify one way. Or even if two of them testified, they'd still ask the third person because they knew he was there. It would be, but usually no one would volunteer to be the third witness. They'd rather wait for the next trial when this one is thrown out. If they really are seeking justice, they'll do nothing. They'll just stand still. If they're really seeking justice, they won't want to be the third witness.
You forgot one thing, too.
Right.
This is something that I did in the Mishnah of Sanhedrin the other week in the shul over here, between Mincha Maariv. Okay. Then at that particular point, we discussed how do they try to put the fear of God into the witnesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they tell them, look, if it's a capital case, you're liable to shed innocent blood, and the blood of this person's descendants that would have come from him, and so on and so forth, etc., etc. And then at the end over there, and says, and what if the witness says, Mali Litzorazu, what do I need this Sora for?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By coming forth in order to testify?
Especially if he loses.
Right? So the answer is, because the Torah says, what? That a witness, Imlo Yagid, Venosa Avono, if he doesn't come forth and testify what he witnessed, then in that case he has to bear the punishment for his failure to come and to testify.
Right.
So that a witness does have a moral obligation to come forth and to testify. So that's the reason why, whether it's two witnesses, three witnesses, four witnesses, okay?
I think I understand.
To come along with the option of telling the truth.
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Is that the option? He comes forth, he says that he should be the witness.
Right.
But now he should come and tell the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to have a problem with that,
because
too.
Because he knows that there's penalties. He knows that, and he's wrestling with it.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's tight.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. All right, let's take a look at the Rashi for a moment. Okay? It says, Mishal Shema moments, the second line towards the end.
Yeah.
Okay? All right, it says, Im Shlosha Eidim Hain, if they are three witnesses, right? Oh, Arba'or, what if there are four witnesses who came forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Mishal Shin Beinehem, right? Then in that particular case, they are mishalesh among them, which means literally they split it up into three, right? Bezdin naasin shalish b'nehen, okay? Mishalmin, right, but mishalmin, right, so bezdin naasin shalish b'nehen, lahashvaisim b'feron. So, in other words, the reason is then that they all have to be made alike when it comes to pay, right? Ishtafi chelko, each one according to his share. Okay? So, inami. So now Rashi comes forth and he brings another interpretation. In other words, that Mishalshin doesn't necessarily mean just to split it into three, but it would mean in general that you have to share the penalty. And he says, Hi Mishalshin, he says, this expression, Mishalshin, he says, is Lishtafi almahu. He's using, ordinary human language. In other words, people were using this, you pay a third, okay? Mechalken ha-peiron ben shloshtan, right? In the sense that to divide the payment among the three of them. But, now Rashi adds, v'hu ha-din name. Same thing applies, imar ba'or, let's say that there are four witnesses, then in that case, ein merabin, then in that particular case, they have to pay a fourth of the share. Okay. All right, now to get back to the text over here. All right, so we've learned then, what does it mean, Shalim Mefi Chelko? So it means that they have to pay their share, but when it comes to Malkus, they get the full amount. Okay, so he says, Ela Kegon, but perhaps the case that we're talking about is a different case. It's Kegon de Itzum, maybe it was like in a case where they were proved to be Adam Zomimim, right? Okay? Kegon de itzum chabinayim. Maybe it's a case where one of them was proved to be. In other words, you know, there are two witnesses over there, all right? And, you know, someone comes along and he says, you know, let's say the witnesses were, Joe and Paul, all right? All right, Safagani. So let's say the witnesses come forth, new witnesses come forth, and they say, hey, Joe, how can you say that? They didn't say Paul, but they said Joe, all right? How can you say that when, you know, you're playing poker with us at the time that you claim? Okay? So in that case, go to Itzim Chadbinayim. Let's say that only one of the Adam, you know, was declared to be an Eid Tomim, right? He was a false witness. So, the Mishalim Palgo Didei, right? So then, in that case, if only this one was, but he still has to pay how much? Not the entire amount, but he pays only his share. Right, literally his half. Okay? So far, so good, right? But now the Gemara says, what do you mean to me, Mishalim? You expect him to pay? Oh, Tanya, didn't we learn that Ein Eid Zomei Mishalim Momem Ad She Yozumu Shnehem? That an Eid Zomei does not pay money unless both of them have been declared, you know, that they were Eidim Zomim?
Yeah.
So, see, this is right. Like, this is what I'm.
Right.
This is what bothers me. Perhaps it'll be resolved. Okay.
No, that doesn't mean that testimony stands. It just means they won't be assessed the standing penalty.
Yeah, correct. For whatever it would be. I mean, after all, right. I mean, if you know, in other words, according to the first opinion, right, where it says Gondit Subchad Binayu, right. So the idea being, I mean, let's say that you know he declared that Chaim still owed, you know, Reuven, let's say, $600. So in that case, how much should he pay if he's the only aide who was declared to be a Zomim? So the Gemara says that in that case, it stands to reason he should pay $300, right?
See, what I see
but
is
now the Gemara comes along and it says, how can you make a statement to that effect when, in reality, you can't accept just, you know, you can't say this one is an aide Zomim?
To define the issue, what I see is there's a tension here between two viewpoints. One is, I think, perhaps viewpoint that the majority favors, that we would instinctively favor, is that anyone that brings a false accusation should be liable for punishment because of the wrong he's trying to do to his fellow man.
Correct.
He should be punished. All
right. Right.
The other is a more strictly legal argument, which is that if you need two witnesses to convict, all right, and if only one is testifying,
it's not only
falsely,
a conviction. I mean, whatever it may be. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be capital cases, you know. But it's understood. I mean, it applies to monetary cases.
Okay, but just follow me.
Yeah.
If you need two witnesses, who would be testifying falsely together to testify in order to ensure the conviction, in order to ensure that the wrong that they wish to visit on their fellow will be visited on him.
Yeah.
All right?
Right.
And if only one person acts, then even if this person acts with the blackest of hearts, he still is unable to effectuate what he wants to do. He's unable to convict the other person. So basically,
you're right about that.
There's that tension that there's a strict legal argument. Why should he be punished?
Yeah. There are only some very rare cases where the testimony of one witness is considered sufficient.
Yeah,
there are a few cases like that, but not in these kind of cases.
Not in criminal cases,
not in monetary cases. You know where we can accept Eid Echod? It's an Emon and the Isura. In other words, if, you know, let's say, one of the finest examples is the fact, let's say that the husband has disappeared. Okay. Disappeared. And naturally, his poor wife has left. She's an aguna, right? Until what point? Until somebody can come and bring evidence that they saw that
he got killed,
right? Okay? Then in that particular case, we're not going to wait to find two witnesses in order to testify that he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
One witness would be enough. Okay? Not only that, but it doesn't even have to be a man. Here is a case where even a woman's testimony is accepted. which is unusual in Jewish law, I have to confess. I mean, they didn't believe in equality necessarily when it came to testimony. Okay.
All right.
They weren't egalitarians. In some cases they were, but not in every case. So, but in that case, I mean, the testimony of a woman too, if she said, you know, I saw that, you know, I saw him killed. But
how do they resolve this question?
They both have to be declared Eidim Zilmumin. Otherwise, you're correct. I mean, there's nothing that they could do. Their testimony would not be. One person cannot do it. So, Omar Rava. So, Rava comes with a different idea. And he says, you know what the case is over here? We were saying that, you know, one witness, he says, but Omer, where he says, Eidu Sheker Hayidosi. The witness says, hey, you know what? I really testified falsely. So in other words, what Rabbi is suggesting is that if the witness says, I testified falsely, then in that particular case, even though the other one did not come along and say that, so how much should he pay in order to make up for the loss of the money that he would have inflicted the other guy, right? So in that particular case, we say that, you know, he would pay his share, right? But they throw down that argument too, because the next statement says, and it's a very difficult statement, it says, Kol Kamine, is it at all? Do you think that he has the power to do this? In other words, can a man come and say, hey, you know what? I testified falsely. Can he do that? We have a principle again, this Gemara, in various places, on Hedrick, Subis, and you name it, various places, and that is Kevan Shehigin. Once a man has testified, Shuv Einu Chozer Mamagid, then he cannot go and retract his testimony.
That's interesting.
In other words, when you testify, you have to know before whom you are giving witness, right? That there is a Rabbeinu Shel Olam HaTevelt, and that, you know, a person's life could depend upon it, and if it's not a person's wife, it could be a person's life, it could be a person's possession, whatever it may be. And therefore, you should be very, very circumspect in what you testify. And you can't go around and saying, oh, whoops, I made a mistake. I told a lie. That's not the way. Once you've given testimony, you've got to stand by that testimony, and that's it. You cannot retract it, okay? So if that's the case, if he doesn't have, so how could we say that he said, Eidu Sheker Hayidosi, right? How could he say that I gave false testimony? So, Elo, says the Gemara, Ba'omer he'adnu u'zamnu be'vezdim ploni, right? He says, you know, that the witnesses, these Eidim Zilmumin, come and they say, we gave testimony and we were declared Eidim Zilmumin in court A. In other words, where the original case was tried. Okay?
Huzamnu.
Right. They weren't invited, but they were declared to be Eidim Zilmumin. Okay?
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is not... It's not...
This is not the original court, okay? When do they fess up that they were wrong? That they told,
court.
Right?
Another court.
That they were declared Eidim Zilmumin? That's in court B, not in court A.
Huzamnu is to say that they were declared
false. We were declared,
not
right,
that they were summoned.
Right. Right. Because if they wanted to say, and we, then it would be Hizamnu, not Huzamnu. You understand? There's the difference between the active and the passive, right? Between the Hifil and the Hufal, okay?
But wouldn't it be if we were summoned?
No. If we were summoned, would be Huzmananu.
Huzmananu. Oh,
right. If I want to say, for example, who was born the Suda, right? It means that he was invited to a Suda, something like that. Huzmananu. So it's a different verb, okay?
That's what I want to know.
Right.
Okay.
This verb is from Zamam.
Right, thanks.
Right, which is the root of this word. Mm-hmm. And the other one would be from Zamen, Zman. That's the root of the other one, okay? All right. So, if they come now and they say, you know what, we were declared to be witnesses, Eidim Zilmumin, in Beis Din A, and they're saying this to Beis Din B, and they say, V'chu yavnu momon, right, and we really owe money to whom? To the guy you know, against whom we testified
originally
falsely, right? Obviously they didn't pay the money. Why? They ran away. This is what we said before about the statement of Rabbi Akiva, remember? Getting back to Rabbi Akiva again, okay? So they say, you know, okay, so now they said that. So now we say, Salka date chamino. Should we say that, should you reason as follows, that kevan de lechavre de motzi mechayiv le, inasmuch as the person against whom we gave testimony, in the final analysis, he didn't have to pay anything. Why? Because we were proved to be Adam Zomimim. So he didn't lose anything by it. You understand? Mm-hmm. Person against whom we testified, he didn't lose anything by it. So in that case, you know, we should say then, Iu Nami Lo Mechayev. So we would say that these guys too, then they should not, therefore, be obligated to pay the money by Bezdin Bez, right? So therefore, Kamash Malon, for this reason, we learn, they don't get out of it that easy. Okay? That, in other words, what? The implication is that the second Bezdin would have the power to do what? To assess them the money that they should have paid in Bezdin Olav. Okay? Okay. Huh? Yeah. Okay, let's take a look at the Rashi now.
Excuse me, so if their tactic was to go to court B and admit that in court A there were false witnesses and declare that they wished to pay money, and then in the hope that
they could get out of paying.
They could
penalty.
Get out of paying because no actual financial loss was incurred by the person they accused. That isn't going to happen. That Court B
Court B has the right to force them to pay the money. Right.
Okay. Okay. Doesn't absolve them from Court A according to
No, but the point is, I guess, that Court B could collect on behalf of Court A. That's the point. But in the final analysis, they're not collecting on behalf of Court A, but they're collecting on behalf of the judgment rendered by Court A for the person against whom they
Court A is still fully entitled to collect, according to Rebekah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they go back to Court A.
So even if they tried, you know, to escape the jurisdiction of Court A by running to Court B, but Court B has the power, right. This is the idea. All right, so let's take a look at the Rashi over here.
Interesting.
Well, Court A had the original jurisdiction, okay? But Court B, they come and they tell, you know, in Court B, and they think they're going to get out of it. Because after all, they said, look, the guy didn't lose any money, so why should we have to pay money to him, right?
Can Court A extradite?
Huh? No, it's not a question of extradition.
Why would they have to do it? The same country. Why would they extradite?
Well, it's a different jurisdiction.
Well, Haskarah, where you go from country to country.
All right, so it's a different point.
There's a problem with from Medina to Medina, you know, but they're all within the same area over there, obviously. Where are they going to run to in the final analysis?
They've gone to a court in Yerushalayim, and they could have gone to Babel.
Well, then already would be a different problem. But the point then would be that technically the court in Babel could still tell them, okay, we'll collect from you, my friend, and we'll see to it that the original guy gets the money, even as assessed by Court A. That they could do, okay? All right, so...
So the money goes to the accused fellow?
It should.
Well, the fine will go to the accused?
They're the ones, why did they give false witness in the first place? Because they wanted him to lose the money.
Oh, the fine isn't collected by the court. It goes to the accused.
Even if the fine is collected by
the court. No, I mean,
but
kept
the point
by the
is
court.
Right. No, it's not kept by
the court. Not kept by the court.
No, it has to go to the person who is the aggrieved person.
That's very nice. Very good. Yeah. Very nice.
Okay. Rashi. Okay. Kol Kamine.
Kol Kamine.
See that? Kol Kamine?
No, where is it?
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on the seventh line. Okay, right after the last one that we did. You know, we said that the Shalsha maybe could imply. You know, it could be the third, could be Merabin, could be fourth. You know, they split it up. Okay, it says Kol Kamine Dutamiyah, which means this is a question. How can you even say does he have the power to do so? This is what the expression Kol Kamine normally implies.
V'chi yochol hu, right? That's what she says. Can he really lachsobo? Can he really retract the testimony that he gave? V'yipoter hanodon milishalem. And then, you know, this person who has been, who is accused, right, wouldn't have to pay anything. So they say, wait a minute, it's not so, right? They come, so he says, well, you know, it's a case where not one witness came, right, but two witnesses, right? And they came before a court and they said, hey, Adam, we testified. It says, Aniu Pliny, right? I am Pliny, right? I am the so-and-so. But, says Rashi, v'chaveiro, eino modeh, right? The other guy doesn't admit that, okay? So, then, and what is he testifying? He's testifying, v'chuyavnu momo, right? That we owed money to Vezdin, right? Shehuz manu, right? That we were declared Adam Zomim, we proved to be false witnesses. V'hemidonu hanodon bedin, right? Al hazomaseinu. And therefore, the person who was originally accused, of owing the money, he took us to court, correct? Because of the fact that we had given false testimony about him, right? V'chiyavunu bebestin, and he proved that we were guilty before the bestin, right? V'mehu shato, and from that moment, momonuhu gabaihu.
That's right.
Exactly. Which means the money is theirs right now, right? Or from the moment that the Bezdin declares that he owes us the money, then it's as if, this money is collectible by us. So this is the idea, okay? It's our money that's in his hands, okay?
Right. Isn't it the other way around, that the court is in effect saying that our money is his because he proved that we were false witnesses and that...
But, you see, the Nodon, the person who was originally accused by these guys, okay, he has a judgment from the court, from court A.
Exactly.
Right. As a judgment court A, where court A says, these guys were liars, they were Adam Zomerman,
right,
and therefore they owe him this money, and it's as though that they made a declaration, and now that the court itself can be the collector for him. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's as if the court can be the collector now, because once the official decree is made by the court, then it's as if at this particular moment the money that comes to me, that belongs to me as a result of the verdict of the court, is still with them, and therefore I have to get it back from them. Okay. And the Einzer Mashiach Satzmo, and we say that this is not a case where this guy is incriminating himself. Why? Shekevoy Shiyu Elohim, because the judges of Court A have already declared that he is a Russia, that he is guilty and he has to owe them the money. So it's not that he's declaring himself to be a Russia at this moment. The judges already have confirmed the fact that he is, that he's wrong, right? And he owes the money.
This isn't the original man. This is the one witness of the two that admits to be a false witness.
Yeah, correct. Right.
Okay, the original court is...
Right. And he's confessing that he was...
The original court on the complaint brought by the person who was defamed has entered a judgment saying the accuser that confessed, they independently have issued a judgment that he was a false witness.
Correct.
And given themselves the power to collect.
Right. But now let's finish with the Rashi, and we'll see that Rashi has a different interpretation.
Okay.
And the interpretation of Rashi now gives us the following. It says, let's look at the text once more for a second. It says, Kevanu l'chabre le'matzim echayiv le, in as much as, and here we have to understand how Rashi takes it. Rashi takes it in the sense that he cannot condemn the other guy. In other words, the other witness who was together with him, this is how Rashi understands it. So we would think then that this guy, who did confess to being an Eid Zomim, you understand? Should not pay, because if the other guy refuses to admit it, so we'd say then that the testimony is no good.
Don't die,
right? So therefore, Komash Malon, we understand that this guy who says, you know, that I was an Eid Zomim, he has to pay his share. That's the point, as we said before. That's what started the business. You know, Mishalim Chelko, right? Mishalim Tei Chelko. Okay, so back again to the Rashi. So, Kevin Lechaber Lemotzi Mechayev Lei, inasmuch as he cannot make the other guy who was the witness with him, right? He cannot convict him on the basis of his testimony. Why? Why can't he convict the other guy? Why can't he obligate the other guy on the basis of his testimony that the two of them were found to be liars? Because, says Rashi, She'eino ne'emon al chaveiro, because he has already proved himself to be a Rasha, and a Rasha cannot testify against somebody else. We cannot accept the testimony of a Rasha against another person.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, that goes back again to what are the qualifications for giving testimony. They have all kinds of qualifications, and one of them is the fact, you know, if a person is known to be that he's not ne'emon, that he's not trustworthy, then how could we accept his testimony against anybody? So we can say, okay, bud, you admitted that you did wrong, and you also tell us, you know, that Bezdin so-and-so did it. Okay, then pay your share. That we accept. Because in the final analysis, you're not convicting yourself. That was already done by the court. So pay your share of the action. But since you cannot make the other guy pay because we can't trust your testimony, so in that particular case, the other guy can't be forced to do it. Unless, I mean, the best thing, you know, can summon enough authority, you know, in order to force him to. Or to get, you know, more witnesses or something.
More witnesses,
right. Maybe they can find more witnesses. Okay? All right. Now, next week, Amir Hashem, we'll continue with another case, as you can see what the Mishnah is. All right, let's take a couple of minutes here, we still have, before Mincha. All right. The mission now continues with another case where you have a sorrow with Adam Silverman. What do they have to pay? They come and they say, look, we testify against so-and-so. Testify against the Chavis, so let's say Yankel, okay?
Just aggressive for 1 second. What you just said, because he's an Adam Silverman,
he's off the hook as far as this guy's testimony is concerned, because his testimony cannot be used against the other one. Okay? But along come other witnesses who prove that he was also in it, right? Then in that case, you know, then the best one can act, as I interpreted before.
You said in a murder case, you only need one witness.
No, never, never. What I said is that in order to prove that a person is dead so that his wife could remarry, okay, then one witness would be sufficient to establish that.
He was alive. She saw him somewhere alive.
The same thing in that case. One witness is enough. I mean, if he says, look, I saw that he's alive, and then that's it. The poor woman, never. She would have to wait, you know, until either he comes back and decides to live with her again, or he should send a get, or, you know, he have to do something for her sake. Okay? But definitely, I mean, what witness in that case would also be enough to establish that testimony. Okay, so me'idin onu es ish pleini, we testify against so and so shegerash es ishta, right? That he divorced his wife, and he did not pay her ksuba. All right, now what's in the ksuba? Of course, we know that the ksuba that we have today, okay, has the wording that he has to pay if she's a virgin when he married her, so he has to pay her 200 zuz, right? And if she is a widow, a divorcee, or a convert, whatever it may be, in other words, anyone other than, you know, an original Jewish virgin, then he has to pay her 100 zuz. This is the ksuba in case he either divorces her or he dies. But there's also another language in the ksuba itself that they speak, you know, that about tosefto today. Now, what is the tosefta today? In other words, what he adds to the ksuba. So, in Eretz Yisrael today, it's a big deal. And it was the time of the Talmud as well, that she didn't simply get 200 zuz, but if the guy wanted to marry the woman, so usually he had to promise her some more things as well. Okay? Now, this is what we'll be discussing next week in the Yitzhak Hashem. What else did he have to promise her? I understand that in Eretz Israel, you know, when it comes to reading the ksuba, They want to hear. Huh? Well, it's not everybody does. But I understand among the Spartan, particularly, this is so. They want to say, how many thousands of shkalim is the chassan promising to give to her in addition to the 200
shkalim
or something
divorce,
like that?
In
right.
case right. of divorce.
In case of divorce or death, yeah. Because we remember again.
Or death.
Yeah, or death. In other words, this is the estate that he leaves to her.
He dies. Who's going to pay it?
All
of
right.
the estate?
This already is a different question. Who's going to pay? The answer is, of course, that the woman has every right to come to the Beis Din and say, look, here's my ksuba. This is what he promised to me, right? And the Beis Din will say, okay, there are heirs. You know, of course, this is the whole problem, you know, about who inherits. Of course, according to the law of the Torah, it's not the wife who inherits.
Right, exactly.
It's the sons who inherit. They have first right to inherit, okay?
Right.
But the Beis Din also has to make sure that the wife gets what she has been promised. So actually it's taken out of whatever estate would be given to the Yorshin, you know, to the those who inherit, and they have to pay her first before anything else. And if there are daughters, since they don't inherit, but provision has to be made for their sustenance as well.
They create a fictitious debt on the part of the deceased.
Yeah, well, it's not a fictitious. I mean, whatever it is, I mean, the fact of the matter is that technically it's collectible in the Beis Din. Now, as I say, today we have the business with wills, you know, which are run not necessarily according to the law of the Torah. Yeah. And, of course, we have insurance, which is something which did not exist in those days. So as a result, you know, there are other legal arrangements, you know, that have to be made. But in the days of the Talmud, there was no insurance, and they wanted to make sure that a widow would not be left without any sustenance when her husband died, or that daughters would not be taken care of, because as the Gemara says, Gemara Ksubis and other places, okay, it says that let the sons go begging, but not the daughters. Because for daughters, it's a shame that they would have to go begging. Whereas for a son to go begging, all right, you know, he's a man, he can go and do it. So that their rights come first out of whatever has been left over. And then only after, you know, that's been taken care of, then the rest would be divvied up. Okay?
Okay. Ahmed Gimel?
Yeah.
I mean,
We're on Daf Gimel.
Daf Gimel.
Ahmed
Ahmed. Ahmed Ahmed. Yeah. Deep is a difficult legal.
In the middle of the page right now. All right. We started it, and I gave a little introduction, as you heard on the tape over here, about the laws of Yerusha and the laws of Ksuba. Okay. But there are still a couple of other angles concerning Ksuba that we didn't discuss as yet. Okay. All right. Anyway, what are these Edom Zomimim saying? So this is what the Mishnah says. They say, the Yidin Onu es Ish.